All right, so are you ready to dive into a book that's been making waves? I know I am.
Always up for a good book, especially one that's got people talking. What We Forgot.
This one is called I'll Never Cry Again
Okay, I'll Never Cry Again by
by Roberta Kagan.
Roberta Kagan.
And we're not going to spoil the whole thing, but we do have some juicy bits to work with, excerpts from a few chapters, and the prologue. Oh, and we've even got a sneak peek at the about the author section.
Oh, I love those. You can learn so much from those little snippets about the author. It's like getting a glimpse behind the curtain. So, what's the vibe? What kind of story are we dealing with here?
Well, the prologue alone had me hooked. It starts in 1943 at, get this, the Eagle's Nest.
Wow, the Eagle's Nest. Talk about a setting steeped in history.
Yeah.
That place just oozes with, well, a kind of ominous significance, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's like this gorgeous mountain retreat. But you're right, there's this underlying sense of dread in the excerpt, like something dark is lurking beneath all that beauty.
Oh, absolutely. And it's made even creepier by the presence of these children that Hitler seems so interested in.
It's so unsettling, right? Like
Totally.
right away, you're wondering, who are these kids? What's their story?
Exactly. It's like Kagan is dangling this little thread, this mystery that you just have to pull on.
And knowing the historical context, you can't help but think about the Lebensborn program, right? Even though it's not mentioned directly, it feels like she's weaving these historical threads into the narrative. You know, just enough to make you
Oh,
think.
for sure. It's like she's inviting you to connect the dots, to see how these personal stories are intertwined with these larger historical events.
Exactly. Okay, so we've got this ominous setting, and then we're introduced to Picator, who's just a young boy when he experiences this profound loss.
Oh, Pecator, yes.
There's this one scene I can't get it out of my head where he vows to never cry again.
Heartbreaking. Just heartbreaking.
It really is. It makes you think about how we cope with trauma, especially as kids. Like, what kind of impact does a vow like that have on a person?
Right. Like, how do you even begin to process that kind of grief at such a young age? And then, just when you think things couldn't get more emotionally charged, we meet Mila.
Oh, Mila. Their first encounter is in this bustling Jewish marketplace. It's so vividly described, you can practically smell the spices and hear the chatter.
And their connection is instant, like time stops.
Totally. It's more than just physical attraction, though. Kagan introduces this concept of Bashert. It's like soulmate destiny kind of thing.
Oh, interesting. So, right from the start, there's this sense that they're meant to be together.
And of course, their path is anything but easy. I mean, they come from different religions, different worlds, really. And to make matters worse, Mila is already engaged.
Ah, the classic forbidden romance trope. But with this added layer of historical weight hanging over them.
Right. And that weight just keeps getting heavier. As the story unfolds, we start to see these hints about Hitler's rise to power,
Oh.
the growing anti-Semitism in Europe. It's like a storm cloud gathering on the horizon.
There's this one conversation between Picator and a friend that really stuck with me. His friend warns him about the dangers outlined in Mein Kampf. It's a chilling reminder of the historical context they're living in.
Yeah, that part sent shivers down my spine. You can't help but wonder, how can love possibly survive amidst all this hate?
And it's not just external forces they have to contend with. Mila's family, especially her father, plays a huge role in shaping her choices. He's arranged her marriage, and she's clearly torn between duty and her heart.
It's a classic dilemma,
Yeah.
but with such incredibly high stakes. I mean, she risks everything to meet Pitator in secret. And the potential consequences are just huge.
And that's what makes it so gripping. Kagan masterfully balances the intimacy of their forbidden romance with the mounting tension of the outside world.
It's like watching a delicate flower try to bloom in the middle of a battlefield. And somehow, against all odds, they find a way to be together. They even have a son, Jacob.
A little ray of hope in all the darkness.
It is. For a while, we get these glimpses into their idyllic family life. But you know it can't last forever. The Nazis are tightening their grip on Poland. And you just know tragedy is lurking around the corner.
It's like Kagan gives you these moments of light, these little glimmers of hope, before plunging you right back into the darkness.
And that plunge is brutal. The excerpts describe this horrific scene where Pintor, Mila, and little Jacob are rounded up and forced into the Warsaw Ghetto. It's just pure chaos and terror.
The Warsaw Ghetto was a place of unimaginable suffering. I mean, historically speaking, it was just horrendous. And Kagan doesn't shy away from the harsh realities.
Not at all. She paints this really stark picture of the overcrowding, the lack of food, the constant threat of disease and violence is just heavy.
Heavy doesn't even begin to describe it. And then, to make matters worse, we discover that Anshul, Mila's former fiancé, is now a member of the Judenrat.
Oh, Anshul. Talk about adding insult to injury.
Right. He's part of this Jewish council forced to cooperate with the Nazis. It was a really complex and controversial institution, historically speaking.
It makes you think about those impossible choices. Like, what would you do in that situation? How do you even begin to navigate that kind of moral dilemma?
Exactly. And in Anshul's case, there's this added layer of bitterness and resentment. He seems to almost enjoy tormenting Pator and Mila.
It makes you wonder what happened to him, what led him to this point. I mean, is he simply a product of his circumstances, or is there something darker at play?
It's a reminder that even in the darkest of times, human nature is complex. There are no easy answers, no clear-cut good guys and bad guys, and Kagan really forces you to confront these moral ambiguities.
Yeah, it's definitely a thought-provoking read.
But amidst all this darkness, there are still these flickers of humanity. Like Mila, despite everything she's going through, she finds a way to create a sense of normalcy. She gets a job at a school within the ghetto, trying to make a difference for the
It's
kids.
almost defiant,
Yeah.
right? Like a refusal to let the Nazis completely crush their spirit.
Exactly. It's a testament to the resilience of the human spirit that even in the face of such unimaginable horror, people still find ways to hold on to hope, to find meaning, to connect with each other.
It's pretty remarkable. And it's not just Mila who's trying to find a way to resist Piquator. He's taking a much riskier approach. He discovers this break in the ghetto fence and starts venturing out into Warsaw.
Whoa, hold on. Venturing out. That's incredibly dangerous.
It is. At first, he's just trying to get food on the black market, but it soon becomes something more. He starts gathering information, making connections with the resistance movement.
So he's not just trying to survive, he's actively fighting back.
Exactly. And what he learns on these excursions is even more terrifying. The rumors about the deportations are true, but they're not just going to work camps, they're going to death camps.
Oh my God, that realization must have been shattering.
It is. It makes his mission even more urgent, more desperate. He's not just trying to save himself now, he's trying to save his family from certain death.
It's a race against time, and the stakes couldn't be higher.
So Peter's out there risking his life. But we also get these glimpses into what's happening inside the ghetto. Like, people are still trying to find moments of joy.
It's amazing, isn't it, that even in the midst of such horror, the human spirit can still find ways to shine through?
There's this one part where Mila shares her meager rations with a friend, Miriam, so that she can bake a small cake for her daughter's birthday.
It's like this tiny act of defiance, a refusal to let the Nazis steal away every last bit of happiness.
Yeah, exactly. And it makes what happens next even more gut-wrenching.
You're talking about when Jakob is taken.
Yeah, it's just devastating. Ava, Mila's friend, blames herself. She thinks she could have done more to protect him.
It's that guilt,
Yeah.
that so many survivors carried with them.
And then we see it from Horst's perspective, the Nazi officer who takes Jakob. And it's not like he's this mustache-quarreling villain.
Right.
He genuinely believes that he's saving Jakob by taking him to a Lebensborn home.
Which is almost more disturbing in a way,
No,
right?
totally.
Because it shows how deeply ingrained Nazi ideology was. It had twisted even the most basic human empathy.
It's really chilling. And as all of this is happening, the tension in the ghetto is building. There are whispers of an uprising.
Yeah, the situation is becoming more and more volatile.
In Piquior, he's driven by grief and anger at this point. He's not just fighting for survival. He wants revenge.
It makes you think about the nature of resistance, doesn't it? What motivates people to fight back?
It's complex. And then there's Louis, Ada's husband. He's not a fighter, but he's playing a crucial role in the resistance, too.
Oh, how so?
He's raising funds, gathering intelligence, putting himself at risk in a different way.
So it's like there are all these different forms of courage, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not always about physical strength. Sometimes it's about using your intellect, your resources to support the cause.
And it's interesting to see how his relationship with Ava is evolving under all this pressure.
Yeah, how is it changing?
They're both terrified. But their love for each other seems to be a source of strength.
It's beautiful, isn't it? How even in the darkest of times, love can still flourish.
But even love can't protect them from everything. The excerpts describe a typhoid epidemic that sweeps through the ghetto.
Oh, God. Typhoid. That must have been horrific.
It was. And of course, Mila blames herself. She thinks she brought it home from the school.
It's that guilt again, that feeling of helplessness.
Yeah, and Piotr, he tries to comfort her, but it's clear that this is taking a toll on both of them.
It's a reminder of just how precarious life was in the ghetto. how disease could strike at any moment.
And just when you think things can't get any worse, Parator discovers a way to escape the ghetto.
Really? Escape?
Yeah. It's incredibly risky, but it's a chance for freedom.
Wow. So what do they do?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Do they stay and fight, or do they risk everything for a chance at escape?
It's a heart-wrenching decision, and one that will have huge consequences.
So we left off with this huge cliffhanger. Escape or stay and fight? I mean, what would you do?
Oh, man. That's a tough one. I can't even imagine having to make that kind of choice. Life or death, freedom or family.
Kagan doesn't tell us right away what they decide, but she does drop us right into the heart of the uprising.
It's intense.
Right. Oh, totally. Like, suddenly everything shifts. We go from these quiet moments of despair and hope to all-out chaos and violence.
The excerpts really capture the desperation of it all. Those resistance fighters, they were so outnumbered and outgunned.
But they were determined to make a stand.
It's inspiring, in a way, their courage.
And Parator, he's right there in the thick of it.
Driven by so much more than just a desire for freedom, right?
Oh, yeah. He's fueled by this burning need to find Jacket, to reunite his family. I mean, talk about motivation.
It makes you think about the power of hope. How even in the darkest of times, people can cling to that belief that things might get better, that their loved ones might still be out there.
It's pretty incredible. And while all of this is going on inside the ghetto, we also see what's happening with Horst.
The Nazi officer who took Jack up.
Yeah. He's at the Lebensborn home, going about his daily routine, completely oblivious to the chaos and bloodshed just a few miles away. It's such a stark contrast.
It's almost surreal, like two completely different worlds existing side by side.
And the crazy thing is, Horst really believes he's doing the right thing. Like, he's saving these children by taking them away from their families.
It's a perfect example of how ideology can warp someone's sense of morality, how they can justify even the most horrific acts in the name of a greater good.
It's scary, honestly, the power of belief. And it makes you wonder, you know, where do we draw the line? What happens when our beliefs lead us down a path of destruction?
These are big questions, man. Questions that have haunted humanity for centuries.
And Kagan doesn't offer any easy answers. She just presents these characters with all their flaws and complexities and lets the reader grapple with the implications.
It's what makes her writing so compelling, so thought-provoking.
Okay, so back to the ghetto. The uprising is raging. And we see Louis, Ava's husband. He really steps up.
He's not a fighter, right?
No. But he's putting himself at risk in a different way. Raising funds for the resistance. Gathering intelligence. It shows that courage takes many forms.
It's true. Not all heroes wear capes. Or, you know, carry guns.
In Louis's case, his actions are driven by this deep sense of responsibility. He wants to honor the memory of those who have been lost, to protect his community.
It's really moving to see how, even in the face of such despair, people find ways to hold on to their values, to make a difference.
But sadly, despite their best efforts, the uprising is ultimately crushed.
It was a losing battle from the start, wasn't it?
It was. The excerpts hint at the tragic losses, the brutal reality of fighting against such overwhelming odds.
And in the end, Parator and Mila, they're forced to make an impossible choice.
They decide to separate.
Separate? Oh, wow. Why?
It's a calculated risk. They figure they have a better chance of survival if they go their separate ways. Plus, Parator is still determined to find Jacob.
So they're sacrificing their own happiness, their own safety, for the slim hope of reuniting their family. It's heartbreaking. But it also speaks volumes about their love for each other and for their son.
And that's where the excerpts end. We don't know if they ever find each other or if Jacob is okay.
Kagan leaves us hanging. It's one of those endings that stays with you, that makes you want to go back and reread certain passages, to search for clues, to imagine what might have happened.
Ugh, I hate those kinds of endings. I need closure.
I know. But in a way, it's also brilliant. It forces you to confront the ambiguity of life, the fact that sometimes there are no easy answers, no happy endings.
I guess that's true. It definitely makes you think.
And that's what makes I'll Never Cry Again such a powerful read. It's a story about love, loss, resilience, and the complexities of human nature in the face of unimaginable evil.
Well, you've definitely piqued my curiosity. I'm going to have to check this one out.
You should. It's one of those books that will stay with you long after you turn the final page. And with that, we'll wrap up our deep dive into I'll Never Cry Again. We hope this conversation has inspired you to explore this powerful story for yourself. Until next time, keep reading, keep learning, and keep those pages turning.